Welcome to FTK Over the Air, and this week we're joined by Dr. Ashley Podransky, Dakota State University. Ashley, I am super happy to have you here. We met almost 6 years ago when I think it was Dirk Simmons connected us for, or connected me with you for appearing at a Gen Cyber conference, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about you and why it's so cool that you're here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. And you're right, Dirk introduced us, and I still have yet to meet him in person. So I need to make that happen. I am Ashley Podransky. I am the Vice President of Research and Economic Development at Dakota State University. Back when I met you initially, I was a faculty member, a professor of digital forensics in our Beacom College of Computer and Cyber Sciences at DSU. I have been in the field of digital forensics for about 15 years, and I started teaching digital forensic courses 15 years ago. And the FTK academic program was what got me into using your tool. But at Dakota State University, we are a center of academic excellence in cyber defense, cyber operation, and research that's designated by the NSA and DoD. We have a lot of students who are studying very technical areas of cyber operations and cyber defense. So that's a little bit about who we are at DSU and the type of programs that we have.
Small list of cool things that I think people are interested in. One of the things I wanted to talk about in that realm is, how did you, obviously in general maybe, but how did it go from, what was the genesis of, hey, I'm teaching forensics here, to let's make this what it is now? What was the catalyst to really jump that to that point?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, 15 years ago, the digital forensics field was night and day difference than what it is now. Now we see a lot of mobile, but back then it was full desktop computers that you had to take the hard drive out and create your forensic image with. And at that point, taking a look at the different tools that are available to do different things. So if you're going to make an image or recover images, you know, extract pictures from a forensic image or computer or things like that, I wanted to use a tool that brought everything together as much as it could. And so I was looking at FTK and the different capabilities within that suite of tools. And so I learned about your product, and I got a demo version. I enjoyed it. And so then I went through the program to become certified, so that way I could get the academic license at DSU. One of the things that sets us apart from a lot of universities is our very applied curriculum. And within there, you know, our students learn the foundations and theoretical aspect of it, because we don't want to just train to a tool, because when things change, we want them to be able to change with it. But integrating FTK into our curriculum was fantastic. Our students were able to get, you know, hands-on experience with different tools within your suite, within, you know, Imgur, PRTK, FTK itself, and so that registry viewer, things like that. So my background with FTK academic program goes all the way back to West Mantooth. those of you on the call will know what that means.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, yeah. Good old Wes.
Yes. He was into a lot of questionable activities.
At what point did you decide, or what was the catalyst to really be like, you know, we should start partnering with bigger things, and we should go bigger, and we can talk about this more, but it's not just necessarily purely academic anymore?
No.
What caused that shift into being more, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a very forward-looking digital forensics lab on campus, DigForce. Digital Forensics for Cyber Investigations. And that lab was created through a partnership of a number of entities. In the state of South Dakota, where we're located, our law enforcement partners were struggling with the shift to criminal investigations with digital data. You know, I've heard them all say that every crime has a digital counterpart, and digital activity to crime is the same as DNA to investigations. So every crime, regardless if it's an in-person or virtual crime, digital crime, has some sort of digital component, from phone data. You know, your cars have records of location, your computers, you know, your smart devices that you have in your home, your wearables. Everything has a digital component, and law enforcement in our state was struggling to keep up with that. And so I had helped law enforcement around the state on a number of cases over the years. And then we talked with our Attorney General's Office, Consumer Protection, and we worked with them to stand up a lab that was funded by them for use to help with digital investigations in the state of South Dakota. So we conduct digital forensic cases. We have a DCI agent that's located in our lab. We also conduct research on emerging devices and investigative approaches. And then we also train law enforcement on digital identification and analysis of evidence as well. So we have three directives. We expanded into, with a grant through our state Homeland Security, on cyber intelligence. So using open source intelligence to gather data for situational awareness for law enforcement as well. And then we also have a program with the University of West Florida with a funding opportunity that's supported by the National Security Agency on training law enforcement and military on open source intelligence and dark web investigations. So what started as implementing a tool to teach hands-on computer forensics, you know, switched into a lab where our students were trained on a tool and adopting that tool into our lab, and then helping our law enforcement partners, anyone with a nexus to South Dakota, were able to do casework for. So last year, Dr. Erica Colm, she's now our director of the lab, and last year she took in over 300 cases from, wow, you know, local, state, tribal, and federal agencies connected to South Dakota.
Very cool. That's a lot of cases. I know, yes. From my days, that's about where it is. So it's not slowing down by any means.
Well, and every case has multiple devices, yeah, right? I mean, right now I'm looking at my desk and I have a phone, an iPad, a computer, a wearable. And there's two computers behind me.
Yeah.
So every case has multiple pieces of evidence as well, which makes it even more challenging.
And our storage is getting bigger.
Oh, yes.
The new, I'm a Pixel, I'm a Google Pixel phone user, and yeah, this year they didn't even sell anything lower than 128 gig. Normally I go 64, but nope, smallest is 128, and yep, that's the trend with all of our storage. It's getting larger, so.
A terabyte on iPhones. I mean, yeah, we don't need that many pictures or videos.
I know, I know. I've been on campus a couple times. You guys have a great setup. Do you find that with the students generates interest in your program as well? Kind of this positive feedback loop of having the various partnerships that you have on campus?
Oh, absolutely. We have, you know, right now I'm a year out of the classroom. I, as the vice president of research, I focus on our research within the university and supporting the faculty. But, you know, I spent my time from an instructor to a full professor on campus. And what I can tell you is that the students that we have are very excited to learn about the different types of things that we're doing in our facility here and opportunities for careers like that once they graduate. We have a couple students working in our lab on things that they can help with. So, for example, we had a case with the DEA where we were given a drone, and the drone was dropping contraband items into a secure facility. And so we had the drone, and we had to analyze, see what we could get from the drone. And what we were able to do in ways that we can use and provide opportunities for students is that the student We bought this exact same make and model drone, and we got it at the same firmware version as the one that we had in evidence, and we had them learn usability on it. Connect it to a phone, connect it to an iPhone, an Android, a tablet, see how you control it. And now let's start to analyze the devices to see what data that we can find on it. And so essentially they give us a good roadmap of where we need to look when we investigate the real piece of evidence that, you know, of course students can't interact with, but they can help provide evidence there. Or they can help provide the analysis that goes into our process. Another good way that we're able to give opportunity to our students, but also help in our investigations, is understanding current indicators of compromise, IOCs. Mm-hmm. When we know that we're interacting with an investigation with a certain group that has specific IOCs, we can have them help us find the current literature on those different devices and give us some information on it. We just put something out on our lab about AirTags. So when you look at any emerging device and how it can be used properly, but also misused for nefarious reasons, we can have students study those emerging devices and give us help and guidance on ways that we can investigate it when we have it. So, you know, there's a lot of, the New York Times just had a really great article on AirTags. Their tech contributor talked about how she put AirTag, another GPS device, another geolocation devices on her husband and her husband's car and different things. Nice. To see which devices were the most reliable, mm-hmm. and which ones were able to gather the details that they needed. So we had our students look at AirTags in a research process that we can then bring into our lab on investigation sites as well. So they get good experience, but of course they can't do the investigations that we have in front of us.
I love that. So I when I got my master's degree, it was like, write a thesis, and you're kind of like, and you know, like on what? You know, and they're like, something in the industry that hasn't been written before. And you're like, I don't like now if yeah. if I like traveled back in time, I could. Oh, yeah. Like I got a million things I could write on. But then uh-huh. it was like, I didn't know. It was like this mad dash to do research just on what hasn't had research. And so you're providing those students with not just, you know, hey, this is what forensics is and this is how you do it. But this is real stuff. Now you can't work mm-hmm. the case, but do you want to do research on drones? Here's research on drones. You want to do research on this? So it's so much better for the student as well. So much more engaging. And I love to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In that vein, what trends are you seeing with students as they go out? How is this education at the university or universities, but since you're seeing yours, how is that affecting the market, or for lack of a better term, the forensic landscape? Because I got a degree in cyber forensics, but it was still like kind of this, we're building it as we fly it type program. Yeah. And yeah. cyber forensics, as you mentioned, I got my degree a decade ago or plus, you know, and was doing it before that. So it's changed so much. How are you seeing the students coming out so well educated with experience changing how forensics is done today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. This field is emerging as we speak. We're building the plane as we fly it, if you will. The great thing about, and I say kids, but students now, they've grown up completely with technology being integrated into everything that they do. You know, when you or I were young, we brought report cards home on pieces of paper, right? That were filled out by hand. There were Polaroids if you wanted that instant camera or instant picture. If you wanted to, you know, the disposable cameras, right? Or when Sony Mavicas came out, that was the coolest thing for digital cameras with the floppies. But, you know, students now have grown up with every aspect of their life, from their academics to, you know, health or anything, being digital. And so they have a good handle on technology, its uses, and how people can misuse it, which I think is a foundation to anything in this field, is that being curious of, okay, so here's how I use it, but an unintended consequence, I can do this. Or, you know, how do I know if someone did this or someone hacked my account? You know, my 6-year-old talks about hacking. Oh, someone hacked my Roblox account. And like, okay, well, we'll get it back. And we have. And then we had to talk about, you know, multi-factor authentication with the 6-year-old. And he got that.
Yeah.
But so I think one of the biggest things now is that our students now have grown up with technology. And so they're not intimidated by it. Where, you know, when I had my first computer, it took up half a dining room table because that's just how they were.
Yeah.
And it was intimidating, but so that's a good thing. The way that it's shifting the landscape is that we have 3 core areas of computer and cyber science that we teach. We have cyber operations, which is more on the offensive side. We have cyber defense, which is on the defensive side. And then we have computer science. I would say 5 years ago, you weren't seeing a lot of pure computer forensic careers posted, and we're seeing a lot more of those now. But when you look at any other discipline that they could go down from, you know, development to networks to security, having that digital forensics knowledge of, okay, when something happens, here's how we ensure integrity. Here's how we can, you know, make an image if we need to, or grab the RAM. If we have something that we're suspecting, here's the triage process we can take. Because something's going to happen. It's just how well you handle it and how well you fail when it comes to computer forensics. So when we look at the landscape and we look at the students that we have now, their background definitely contributes to, you know, the quick advancements that we're having in this field. They understand cloud in a way that was not second nature to you and I when we did this, because, you know, cloud didn't really exist then. And so they understand all of that, which helps advance our field further, faster, I think.
For sure. One of the things that we still see today, which no shade to any of these people that came up this way, is in law enforcement especially, you'll have a detective. One of my friends that works here now, but I met him in Ohio, it was something like he knew how to fix email. You know, like something was wrong with email and they called him in. He was a detective and they're like, oh, you fixed our email. You're going to OPATA, the Ohio Peace Officers Training Academy, and learning how to do digital forensics now.
Yes.
And he's like, okay. And then off he went. And for him, it started a new career. But there's a lot of investigators that are getting thrown into it late, or I don't really know much about it, and they're being pushed in. I've seen those as well, and they do good work and they do the best they can, but now we're getting them young now and educating them as they come up to hopefully make our next generation of investigators. You know,
that was the philosophical debate that happened in South Dakota for a long time. Do you give a cop a computer or a geek a gun? Which way do you go?
Yeah.
And I heard that phrase so many times because they'd been debating it. And so we thought, well, let's try the geek route. And again, their words, not mine.
Yeah.
And let's work with the university to see what we can do. And I would say that that's been a really good partnership. It's taken a while to get our footing. You know, we all talk different languages. We all have different expectations of what success looks like. One of the hardest things for me to learn throughout this whole process is that what I consider a win is not what they consider a win. So we had a case where this was 2 or 3 years ago. It was a local business in South Dakota. She had a boutique and shipped products nationally. And she had her Instagram account and her website, and that's how she communicated mostly with her audience, her customers. Well, it was 2 days before Thanksgiving, And she went, she woke up, looked at her phone, and she had an email from someone saying, I have your Instagram account. And she wanted, she thought, well, that's weird. And so she went out to Instagram and she's like, oh yeah, my account's gone. It's not even, it's, you, they changed the name. They did a lot of things with it. Well, I talked with her and she said, you know, this is my busiest time of year. If I don't have my account back, I'm going to lose a substantial amount of my income for the year. And, you know, it's a small South Dakota business that employs, I think she has about 10 to 15 employees. You know, a successful business, but a small business. And when you look at the statistics of small businesses, when they have a cyber attack, you know, I think it's like 80% are out of business the next year because they just can't recover from it. And so I did some back channeling to get her Instagram account back. You know, first thing I did is have her report it to law enforcement and go down that path. But I had a friend of mine who runs security for Facebook and then Instagram. She was able to get the account back very quickly. And I consider that a big win. So now you have a business, you have them back up and running. They were able to pick a point in time to get all of their contacts back, get their posts back, all of that. And then we talked about, you know, multi-factor authentication and other things like that. But law enforcement did not consider that a win because they want to see the bad guy in handcuffs. And so I totally get it. So I understand their perspective. My view was simply to get the business back up and running to keep her in business. So, you know, that's been one of the hardest things we've had to look at is what's a win for us is not a win for them. And so how do we work together to define what that win looks like as we move forward? So we've come a long way since that incident. I think it was 2019, but it's, or even 18 perhaps, but it's a good reminder of the type of activities that happen within cybercrime and how it impacts the Main Street businesses that you walk past every day.
Yeah. So that was an education for me when I jumped to Access Data years ago, because former law enforcement, so I'm in that mentality. Either my evidence shows that no crime was committed and we walk on to the next one, or my evidence shows that something bad probably happened and somebody's got to go to jail. And then I get to Access Data and we sell a lot of FTK Enterprise and different things to corporations. And they're exactly that mentality that you described. Listen, all I need is my business back. You know,
yeah.
I just need to be up and running so that I can make sure my customers are served, make sure their information is secure. If sometime down the road we give the information to the law enforcement and somebody gets arrested, fine, cool, great. You know, but priority one, get me back up and running. Mm-hmm. And then I loved the cop versus geek thing, and I'm not offended by the term geek by any means. You can kind of see my background here, but I have a weird thing. If I can tangent for a second, I was going to school undergrad with a computer information technology degree, and no offense to any IT people watching, but oh man, I started looking at the IT field. And I was like, that isn't me. And at the time I was working for campus police, and my minor was sociology with an emphasis in law enforcement. And I'm like, you know, this is where it's at. I loved working with the police. I loved that whatever. So I was like, I'm just going to go be a cop. So I started that whole process, PT testing, all that junk. And one of my professors was like, hey, you can do both. You should go do this. You can be a computer cop, basically. And that's what I did. But it was interesting because I got a job at the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and they didn't give the geeks guns. we just sat in the lab. The detectives from around the state would bring us the stuff. So there's very different types of models out there to make this successful. And I think universities and programs like yours are educating the upcoming investigators, and then agencies can figure out what works for them. Do we put them on the street as a detective and, you know, he's got this dual set? Mm-hmm. Or do we put her in a lab? Or do we put her in a tangent team out of, you know, it's just like all over. And all of these things can work depending on the situation. And so we have a lot of options.
Absolutely. You know, and it, you know, we don't literally have guns with our geeks here, but it's definitely, you know, we found that that does work here in South Dakota, but it's that constant partnership. So we have, with our lab, it's a lab at Dakota State University, but we have a director of law enforcement engagement, and we have a director on the DSU side as well. So we have DCI, Division of Criminal Investigation Leadership, and University Leadership working together in tandem. And that was that's a secret sauce for us.
Perfect. One thing I want to kind of jump to is we're talking about the next generation of investigators, the whatever. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the next a little bit.
Yeah.
What connected us, we mentioned this earlier, years ago, was the Gen Cyber program.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be better if you described what that is, and then we can talk about, and I have a few questions related to that, but what's that program?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was about 8 years ago that the National Science Foundation and the National Security Agency, they wanted to do something to look at the on-ramp of youth. And they created a program called Gen Cyber. It's the next generation of cyber professionals. And they wanted to reach kids when they're in middle school or high school, so that way they could introduce what this field is about. And so I love this program, this camp. It gives a lot of flexibility to the local people hosting the camp. So the NSA, they sponsor about 150 camps every single summer on at different universities throughout the country. At Dakota State University, we have all three types of camps they offer. They offer teachers camps. So if you want to train high school and middle school teachers who are teaching cyber on lesson plans, approaches, hands-on things. So we have a teachers camp. They have a high school camp, a co-ed camp. And so we have that on campus as well. It is the largest camp that they fund for co-ed residential camps in the country. And our teachers is the largest camp that they offer. And then we have our girls-only camp. And that is also the largest girls-only camp that the National Security Agency sponsors, that's residential here in South Dakota. So out of all 150 camps, we have the largest in each of those categories. We have residential camps, and it's quite simple. There's camps all across the country that will be day commuter camps. So drop your kids off at George Washington University at 8, pick them up at 5. Everything's great. But we don't have the population for that. We don't have the population to have kids be dropped off by parents on their way to work and pick them up. We would have very small camps. So our co-ed camp is 200. Our teachers camp has a capacity of 50. And our girls only camp has a capacity of 125. And they spend a week on campus and they learn about the foundations of cyber. So we have programming, network. We do Python, networking, cyber. We do open source intelligence as well. And then computer forensics is a big area of focus. And so it was several years ago, I was emailing back and forth with Dirk, and he noticed on my signature line, the Gen Cyber Girls Camp. And he said, well, tell me about that. And so I told him about it, and he's like, well, we need to get someone to your camp to do some lessons. Yes, let's do it. That's great. And so that's when I met Justin. So the Gen Cyber program is created by the NSF and NSA in order to introduce cybersecurity concepts to kids, to encourage them to study it at college, and then ultimately become professionals. But in the event that they don't take that path, we have students who learn more foundations and are less likely to be the people that click on an email, for example, or Try and open an infected attachment, for example. So we're regardless if the students go into this discipline, we are teaching kids lessons that they can use in any industry that they decide to go down.
One thing I liked, every time I go there and we're chatting and doing our lesson and talking with the girls, they'll always be like, my mom does this thing that she, you know. I think this, we were talking about picture forensics this last time, and we were going over all the information that's stored within a picture, and they had taken open source intelligence stuff the day or the morning prior, and they were like, yeah, my mom always takes like first day of school pictures in front of our house, and they would tell me about how that was. So to your point of learning survival skills in the digital landscape, I guess, is a great thing about that camp. And it's been going for 8 years. So if we think middle school, these girls, these boys that have gone through this are now college at minimum. What are some success stories? You know some this change that has taken place with maybe a few of your students. So,
yeah, I love this question. So we don't have a formal IRB process to track students from middle school on up. However, anecdotally, I can tell you some cool things. With our very first camp, we had a student, and her name is Annabelle. And she is now a student at DSU, and we employ her. And so she's working and creating new programs and leading outreach for students like she was when we first met. I have a lot of examples of that. We have 15 students hired this year that are working for CyPER doing outreach and activities. And a majority of those students we first met when they were campers. And one of the coolest things I think at DSU, and I attribute a lot of this to the camp, is that from the fall of 13 to the fall of 19, we've had a 595% increase in women studying computer and cyber science programs at DSU. We went from about 40 students to over 180. And that's simply the avenue that I think CyPER has created. So we have two guiding philosophies. When we're at camp, you've never heard us say that we're 10% of the field. Why would we tell them that? They're middle school girls trying to figure out who they are and fit in. And so they don't want something else that makes them weird in their mind. Yeah. And so instead, we just show them what the field is. We introduce women who are in this space doing great things. And that's how they learn. And then two is we don't lecture. We show them hands-on activities. And then we have them explain to us what it is that we're talking about. So, for example, with the XF data on the images that you're discussing, we show them a picture and then we start looking at all the data behind it, the geolocation of when it was taken, the date, time. You know, there's a Google map that you can get right to the location of the image of it that was taken. Was it a front camera or back camera? What direction were they facing? All of those things where they can start to see that. And so then we ask them, like you mentioned, why is it not a good idea to take a picture in front of your house with your house numbers behind it? So, there are things like that that bring in the social aspect of it as well. So to get back to the question, it's taking a look at what this field is, busting some stereotypes, and showing them positive role models that I think helps make the difference.
When the students are on campus, what's some of the feedback you're getting from the girls right then and there, though? Because they're meeting with lots of industry professionals, from software to actual investigators, agencies. What is their reaction while they're in it?
Yeah, I love it demonstrates how influential role models are to kids. One day we're showing the girls how to crack passwords, not to create little hackers, but just to show them why you need secure passwords, right? How easy it is to crack a password. And then the next day we had the FBI come, and we had the cyber team from the Minneapolis field office. And one of their investigators, I can't say her name, but she had her sunglasses on, and we had sunglasses at camp. And so then they all took their picture wearing their sunglasses with the FBI agent because they thought, we want to be in the FBI. That's cool. And so seeing them relate to the role models that we put in front of them, so that way they can see what the field is and to get that confidence. You know, people think of our field as a hacker in a hoodie in mom's basement and that you're working all by yourself. And when they start to see that it is a social environment that kids just like them could go into, you can see that shift for them as well. So when they think coding's too hard, and then they code in Python, they're like, hey, I got this. You know, when they learn how the internet gets to their laptop, oh, well, that's easy once you break it down. So those light bulb moments, if you will, are super fun to see because they're able to start to understand what the field is and, you know, more importantly, what it's not. And they can see themselves in that space as well.
Perfect. Well, Ashley, I'd just like to thank you for coming on today and answering some questions and talking about the great program you guys have built, literally built from the ground up there at DSU. And I think you're changing a lot of lives and contributing to the field of forensics and security in great ways. And I'd like to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And working with all of you over the years has been great. We've enjoyed our partnership and using your tools in our classroom and in our lab, and then the special bonus that you guys bring to camp. That's fantastic.
Always happy to be there. Thanks again, Ashley, and have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.